I'm gonna do some sound techs because where's my friend? Where's my friend? Yeah. As he said, sometimes in this room, either people are really screaming into it and it's hard to hear, or they aren't talking at all. So, so how's this? How's this for the back of the room? Doug, how's this? Can you hear me? Okay. I'll try to keep it here. I'm really nervous though, so I might just put it down. I don't know. Right? I'm just kind of terrified right now. Happy birthday to all the... It's my birthday month too, but it's at the end of the month, and my tradition is to get it not in the beginning of the month, when my birthday's at the end of the month. And thank you to the little guy for doing the birthdays, because and this will help me practice my kid-friendly version of my story. I don't know what that will sound like, but we'll see. And also that I'm getting taped. Oh, good. Can you hear me right now, young man? Good. Okay, he can't hear me. That's good. I brought my daughter when she was young. I got sober when she was 8, and I brought her to meetings with me until the moment we were going up to the Concord Fellowship. That's where I would bring her. And she went, Mommy, I don't want to come here anymore. So I understood. So I could make other arrangements for her. But she was like 10 or 11. She had loved the people at the Concord Fellowship, and they loved her. They were so kind to me and to her. Did I say my name's Lynn? I'm an alcoholic? See, my name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. And, I am scared right now. My heart's beating. I'll take a deep breath. And welcome to all the newcomers. Great to see you here. This is a tricky time. Any time's a tricky time to get sober, but we're about to enter the holidays, and I remember that from when I was getting sober. It was like, now I think of it as the eating season, but back then, every day was the partying days. But I don't even know what I'm saying right now. So I'm going to just tell you what I like about AA is that they tell you what to say. Just your experience, strength, and hope. What it's like, what happened, what it's like, whatever. Well, you know what it is. You know what I'm trying to say. So I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I am the youngest of 6 kids. I was born and raised in Concord. And kind of a big, crazy family. So as adults, we have 3 of us are clean. One of us is very, very impaired with schizophrenia and other things. And 2 of us seem to just function as just normal human beings in the world, which I never really understood. But as a kid, so none of us were in recovery growing up, and it was just crazy household. It was really challenging as a kid to grow up with somebody with untreated, really severe mental illness in the house. My brother had really bad mental illness. He's 10 years older than me, so from the time I was about 3, it was really obvious that something was wrong in the house. And I would just escape from early on. I escaped into food, lots and lots of food, escaped into the TV, into reading when I could read, and into daydreaming, heavy daydreamer. Still am sometimes. I'm way up in my head today, and which is never a good place to be. It just really isn't. It's so good to get out of my head and like be in the flow of the world. But I was up in my head up until, I don't know, still am there a little bit. So anyways, I grew up around the corner from where Jack and Robbie live. So I grew up in the same place that my sisters now live since my mom passed. And, you know, my life, it was kind of like... It was like two different things. Like there was part of my life where like I played soccer. I liked my, you know, I got along really well with my sisters. And there was my mother and my father were great, and they tried to do all the things that you're supposed to do, and you know, sign me up for lessons. And I got to take ballet lessons until I stopped about 2 weeks after they started, and then horseback riding lessons until I didn't want to do that anymore. And they tried. They really, really tried. But I, by the time I was 7, It's so funny because my grandson, me and Doug have a grandson, and he's 9 now, so I'm looking at things like, gosh, when I was that age, you know, I'm kind of reflecting back on that. And when I was 7, I wanted to get the hell out of my house really bad, and I started dreaming of running away. And I would think about that every night, how I was going to escape. And so what happened for me is about the time when I was 12, I did escape, right? I did. I started drinking and using and became a runaway and just started using every day. Right? And it just went from nothing to everything over the course of like a day. I found stuff in my brother's drawer. I stole a bottle from my parents. I went down to the street to the party kids and never looked back after that. And I'd always known, you know, I'd always known what alcohol tasted like. I had been drinking my parents' martinis. Not drinking them, but, like, finishing them. Like, you know, my job, like, all the girls had chores. And my chore was often to clear the table. And I would eat everything, and I would drink everything. So I always knew what a martini tasted like, and I knew what that olive tasted like. And I was hitting off my dad's Chesterfields for as long as I could remember also. So, you know, it wasn't like I went from little Pollyanna to something, but it was just this thing that happened. So I picked up and started drinking and using when I was 12, and by the time I was 13, I was dropped out of school. I'd already been truant. I just found these old report cards were just, you know, in seventh grade I'd missed like 80 days or something, you know, and my poor mother had no idea. Nobody let her know, and she got this. I remember her getting this thing, and she's like, "Where have you been? Like, where, you know?" And I was just out ripping and running every single day. And so, as you know, I started running away from home, started getting into harm's way, all the stuff that just happens to young girls when they're running away from home and getting in harm's way. And had a baby when I was 15. And thought that was going to cure me. Really, when I found out I was pregnant, I'm in a local clinic, and she says, "You're pregnant," right? Because she thought this was not a good thing, right? For this little strung-out 15-year-old to be pregnant. She, the nurse practitioner, could see this wasn't good. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm pregnant." And I was like, I'm going to have, you know, and I just thought I was going to give birth to a family. I just thought I was going to give birth to a white picket fence and a home and all this stuff because I was just so childish and immature and strung out. And that just didn't happen, right? It just didn't happen. I had this baby. She cried a lot. I was a terrible mother, and I thought I was a good mother. My list of what to do as a mother was, you know, you make sure you read to them, and you're there, and you feed them. And I did those things. But what I didn't do was, like, connect with that little human being because I was so just out of it. And I'd like to say I just won't even say it because I wasn't clean and sober during my pregnancy because I didn't know how to be. And that was what happened, and I just became, I eventually moved back in with my parents, and that was good, they helped me raise her, but I became just like for quite a while, just like a dumpster driving, tweaker, prankster, white trash girl. That was me in Concord, and I was the kind of girl you'd run into and behind 7-Eleven at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was just like, I'm freaky, and I was always awake, and my whole life consisted of, like, you know, I would come home and I'd say, "I'm going to bed," and I'd lay in bed at night, go, "Please God, if you'd let me go to sleep tonight, I'd never ever do this again." And then I would get up and I would do it again the next day. I wouldn't get up, I would stand up, because it's not like I'd go to sleep, right? I would just get up and then I'd try to drink myself asleep. And, you know, that was just like every night I would just do the same thing, and I'd just be, "Please God, let me sleep, let me sleep, let me sleep," and I just wouldn't sleep. And what happens, my brother, two things kind of simultaneously happened. My brother got clean, and my brother was the kind of person that was living in the bushes and just, you know, I could look at him and say, "Oh, he's got a problem," right? And I could look at the guy I was dating and say, "He's got a problem," because he used to pee the bed, and that was a clear sign to me that he had some kind of drinking problem. But I could never look at myself and think I had a problem. It never occurred to me that I had any kind of problem. And I think it was because I was usually the one in control. I was like the designated driver, even if I was falling down drunk. I was the caretaker. I was the person who was taking care of other people. So I just didn't see that I had a problem. I had this best friend, Angie. And Angie and I have been best friends. We got kicked out of school together. We went to the community school for the expelled kids together. And so we got kicked out of there, right, when we were 13. And she was helping me raise Emily. And we had given up drugs. So we thought we were clean and sober. We were drinking, but we were like, we had given up the drugs and the hard stuff. And what we were doing was going into Malta's every single day, which is a bar in Concord. It was a bar in Concord. It was just like this little dump bar. And we just loved it there. We had never felt really at home anywhere. It was kind of like Cheers for us. We'd walk in and the bartender knew our names and nobody knew our names, right? We were always kind of late for the party, we always felt like. And so we'd go there every day, and I would go pick up my daughter. So I'd take my daughter to school. We'd take my daughter to school. I'd pick her up, and we'd go, and we'd bring her back to the bar and set her on that bar stool, and they'd let me do that, and we'd drink and drink and drink. And life felt really good, you know, because I was not on the stuff that was keeping me awake at night. My shoulders were relaxed again, and I thought I was doing really good. And that was just every day also. That was my new kind of rut, my new routine. And then one day, me and Angie left the bar with Emily, my daughter. And Angie left my house, and she wrapped her truck around the pole on the freeway on-ramp and died. And that was such a clear sign that we had a problem that I swore I'd never drink again. And prior to that, her brother was actually, Angie and I had this little housekeeping business. And prior to that, her brother had started putting like a letter to the woman alcoholic and all these pamphlets in our cleaning supplies. And I thought these were meant for her. It never occurred to me they were meant for me. But so I was kind of familiar with the program because of that. I had like the woman alcoholic, are you an alcoholic? Are you too young, I think was the other one. And then I also had my brother who had moved back home who had about 3 years clean when this happened. And my brother, he was trying the promotion, not attraction method of 12-step recovery, and he would come in and, you know, say how everything is, and I would look at him and I'd think, gosh, we're both, you know, up at 3 a.m. So, because he'd go to a meeting, he'd go to the meeting after the meeting, then he'd come home, and this is when I was still up tweaking, and I'd be home, you know, doing crossword puzzles or something, and come home, and he would talk about how great the program was, and how, you know, he's really turned his life around, and I'd be like, well, we're both up at 3 a.m., so it doesn't look like much has changed for you, right? And I just had no interest. He also seemed so straight to me, and I had no interest in being like straight like that. Like, you know, I wanted to be like a gangster's mall. Like, that was my like goal in life, was like to be a badass. That was like what I still wanted to be. I mean, I was young still. And so when Angie died, everything that changed everything, and I swore I'd never drink again. And then about a week later, I was back in the bar and I was drunk. And I had no idea why I was drunk, and I would say, I'm not going to be drunk, and I'd go get drunk again. And Angie had been dating this man named Dan, who was in and out of all three of the Contra Costa County jails, probably for the last 20 years of his life before he got clean. And he had done the Deuce program, and he said, you know, I'm gonna get clean, and you want to go with me? Kind of like that. So we went to we got a schedule from my brother, and we went to a NA meeting at the Rainbow Church in Concord. And we went to this meeting, and I don't know if I was sober at the meeting. I think I was, but we went to the meeting, and Dan connected right away. I mean, literally after the meeting, people, like, surrounded Dan, and it was like, it was like, ah, you know, he was like, he raised his hand, and people were like, keep coming back, brother, it's going to be okay. And nobody talked to me at all, like nobody. And that was usually always the case. And the truth was, Dan was like this friendly person, and I was there, and I won't even say what I used to say, but I had a very, very foul mouth back then. And if you were even looking at me, sort of sideways, I'd just be like, what the F are you looking at? And that's how, this was my body posture all the time. Now it's just when I get really nervous or I don't know what else to do with my arms. But back then, I mean, I was just like this. And back then I was chain smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day. You know, I had like one ripped up pair of boots. I was just scrappy. I had like a bad perm. I was kind of a mess. And nobody welcomed me. Nobody came up and talked to me. And it was a long time before any woman came up and talked to me, to be honest. There was no woman reaching out their hand to me in AA. I was also going to the Concord Fellowship. So those were my meetings. I'd go from the Rainbow Church and the Concord Fellowship. And Dan got it, right? Like, he was all in right away. We had one relapse together after that. And I would go out about every 2 weeks and go drinking. Had no idea, literally would not know why. I'd be like, I'm going to be sober, and all of a sudden I'd be drunk. And I just didn't know why. And then one day in November of 1982, I was leaving a meeting, and I got in my car, was going to go home, drove out to Pittsburgh instead, and ended up on my last run. And what happened was I had a phone list from meetings, and I called this woman, Barbara, and she came and got me, and she 12-stepped me, and she told me, you don't have to live like this anymore, and she said every single slogan there is to say. And I heard her, and she took me over to Dan's house, and one thing that I have always done is I'm kind of a compulsive reader because I'm shy, and so it's easier to stare down into, you know, at a page than it is to look at people. So I've always had my nose in a book, but I had all the literature. I had, you know, the big book, and I had every piece of literature that I could find. And I also, back then in the 80s, Gorski was really big, and I had the Gorski books. And in one of those books during, you know, about 3 o'clock in the morning when I was up, I read that I had a disease, and it described the disease, and it was like the light bulb went out on over my head, and I was like, oh my God, that's what's wrong with me. I have this disease. So when I use, it kicks off this phenomenon of craving, and that's why I can't stop using. I mean, it was like this huge epiphany to me. And I woke Dan up in the middle of the night, and I'm like, Dan, we have a disease. And, you know, he knew that. He'd been going to meetings, he'd been listening. He actually had said he had known he had, like what his problem was for years and couldn't stop using, which to me just sounds like, and I know that's the case for so many people, but just like, hell, I realized what my problem was and I had the big book in my hands and I went to a meeting the next day, got a sponsor and just dove in head first, like was programmed all day, every day. I didn't go to treatment, I went to meetings and that's what I did. My parents graciously would help and watch Emily, and I would go to 3 meetings a day. I got a sponsor the next day. I did anything that man said as far as just like, I worked the steps, I got a service commitment, I did it all. And I just, little by little, slowly but surely, I just started getting better. I just, physically just started getting better. I started being able to sleep. It took years for like the rough edges to start to be kind of shaved away a little bit, but I mean, my physical sobriety, I remember at about 9 months, I would still crave things. But what I'd learned, and what I'd learned in that epiphany is because I really truly used to believe that if I wanted to use, like if a craving came up, that was a sign I wasn't ready to quit. I mean, I really did. I thought that was like a sign from God that meant that I just wasn't ready yet. And that would be reinforced in meetings because there was people back there that'd say, oh, you're just a quart short or something, you know, or you just like, you know, if you're having reservations, you need to go out there and drink again. And I'd go, okay, I'll try that. And you know what? I would never say that to anybody. I just don't think that's a good idea because you can die out there. I mean, it's really bad out there, and we can die. We can die. It's a terrible disease. I was just somewhere, and you know how bad it is out there right now. It's really bad. And I was seeing this girl that just looked like, you know, she was coming from the zombie apocalypse of meth, right? And I'm like, that was me. That was me. And if I was still out, well, I'd be dead, or I'd be doing what they're doing now, which is so much worse. And, but for Grace Goy, seriously. I really was that person, and I would be that person if I took a drink or did anything. I just dove in and took care of, it was like I went to treatment, kind of, you know. So I did way more than 90 meetings, 90 days, got myself a sponsor, made friends, did all the stuff they said to do. Made a little core group of friends, and we would go to the dances, and we would go to the picnics, and we'd do all that stuff. And what it was for me, you know, I had never gone to high school. I had never done any of that kind of stuff. I didn't have any kid experience. I had no normal kid experience, and I started to have all that stuff here, right? I had people be nice to me. I mean, I remember the first time, her name's Christy, most of you probably, a lot of you know her, but I probably had, I don't know, 90 days or 6 months, and she came up to me. I don't know what she was doing at the Rainbow Church. She looked much too nice to be at the Rainbow Church, but she came up, and she was super nice, and it was like the first, I mean, the people I was getting sober with at the Rainbow Church, we were all like, we had all had kind of similar experiences. We were all pretty, we could not get through a sentence without F-bombs and, you know, all of that, and Christy was like a cheerleader or something, and she was genuinely nice to me, and I thought, this is the first, like, nice person who's ever been nice to me, and that happened here, because that wasn't happening in the real world. When I came in here, I didn't know how to shop, I didn't know how to take care of myself, I didn't know how to do any of those things. After a short while, I got a different sponsor, because even as young as I was and as new as I was, I realized that the man, that he was great, but he was never going to help me, like, learn how to be a woman, like a single parent mother that I would. So I got the sponsor that I still have today. I have, so I'm going to have 35 years this in a few weeks. And thank you. Thank you. I got this wonderful sponsor, Tony, who would just help me. She would just help me. You know, in one of our readings, somewhere in here, in one of the things it says, this is not a social service agency. This is not a dating club. It is not. It was all that to me. It really was. The program is all that to me. It was my social. I got my first job through the program. Got a little job as a secretary. My first normal job at the Rainbow Church as the church secretary. And, you know, and got to go to meetings at noontime. My sponsor is a social worker. You know, it's just what a coincidence. I needed a social worker. She tried, you know, and I was wrapped up in the social services department world because of, you know, I was on welfare and housing and all of that for a long, long time. And thank God for that, because, you know, it also put me through school. And my sponsor went to school and I went to school. I had basically a sixth grade education when I got here. I had checked out in about sixth grade. I mean, school was hell for me. I mean, I was bullied. I hated it. I hated everything about elementary school. I was picked on. You know, I was a good reader, but I do have, a dyslexia. I can't, if I tried to read this right now, I would scramble the words, and you would think I can't read it sometimes. And kids aren't nice about that kind of stuff, and kids were not nice. And I got to go back to school, and I took classes on, how to go to school. I took classes on, how to, you know, how to add, subtract, all of that. So I just got to, I got to do a whole do-over here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then after a while, I went to school, and I just couldn't do it. I was so rough around the edges, and I just didn't know how to function in society, and I'd call my sponsor and say, I can't go in there. I just can't do it. And she'd say, just do it. Just go forward. Just don't think. You know, don't think and go forward. And I used to have these cards that had all the character defects on one side, then the opposite. And we'd be like, okay, I just need to act like the opposite. I just have to practice doing the opposite of these character defects. I've never been one. I don't believe that some magic thing's gonna just whip those those character defects away from me. I have to do the footwork, I have to do stuff, and I would practice what the good behaviors looked like, you know? And I did things like, you know, envision what I want my life to look like and move towards that. And the truth is what I learned in here, my life could be anything. I could have decided I wanted to be that gangster's mall, and I could have done that here. I can do anything here. I just don't drink, right? I could do it soberly. And for a while, I mean, there was a 10-year period that, you know, all I was basically doing was staying sober, going to the Concord Fellowship, going to school, and barely being a parent, and I was just scrapping through. And I got, after a while, I quit smoking, got very, very, very depressed. And through the help of my sponsor and outside help, I turned it around, and I got better. And I just, through this program, these steps, prayer and meditation, the 11th step, the 7th step, the 11th step, the 10th step, just every day, I'd have this little list and go, okay, did I do this? Did I do this? I need to practice doing this. And then the morning, you know, in the morning, and I still do that. I get up in the morning, I have a little thing I read, and I see what I'm going to do, and I ask help. You know, I kind of plan out my day, and I ask for help. And my life is so, so different. I mean, so incredibly different. Sometimes I used to, there was a few years ago where I said to my sponsor, well, maybe it's just because I was so young and now I'm so old. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just that I got older. And she said, well, think about it. Think about what your life would have been like if you were this old and you were still doing that life. I mean, one, if I was alive, it would not have been pretty. It would have been really, really awful. Because I run into people sometimes that I was ripping and running with, and they are not well. And it is, this disease is awful. It really is. It is a awful disease that can kill us and make us really mentally ill. And I just, you know, thank God for every day. So what it's like today, what it is like today, I'm going to end way early. Is that okay? That's okay. Everybody loves it when it ends early, right? Because, you know, she said, speak for 45 minutes. I'm like, that's impossible. It's impossible. And also, a good meeting ends early. That's what I think. But what it's like today is I'm married. My husband Doug's here, and nobody ever expected me to be married. I wasn't the marrying kind of gal. And we've been married for 22 years. Been married for 22 years. Boy meets girl on AA campus, and we have a grandson. My daughter had a baby. My daughter's sober, so she's sober, which is fantastic. And, you know, life is mostly just beyond our wildest dreams. We have a really normal, boring life. It is amazing. And the truth is that I don't want to scare newcomers away, because you don't have to have a normal, boring life. You can have a wild, crazy life. You can have just dances and parties, and you just learn to do it sober. And it's just amazing, the stuff that I learned to do sober, that I thought there was no way I could ever do those things. I mean, everything. I had never done anything sober. I'd never been a person sober, and I learned to do all these things. And now I feel like sometimes I'm like, especially talking to newcomers, I think of my brother when he was just so clean cut and straight, and I thought how unappealing that was, and now that's me, right? Now I'm like, nobody would ever imagine me in a dumpster, right? Nobody would imagine me dumpster diving with just like needle marks all over my arms and cigarette hanging out of my mouth and just tweaking. And here I am, you know, here I am. I've had a good, solid career. I've had a career of being of service. I love my work. I love the people that I work with. I was able to be a good daughter to my mother, who passed about a year and a half ago. Me and my sisters were able to keep her in her home while she was on hospice for 3 years. 3 years. Yeah, but we did this rotation where we had a schedule, and we just took turns sleeping there and loving on my mother, and it was really, really wonderful. And when I came in this program, I didn't get along with my mom at all. One, she was still a drunk, and that was hard, but after a while, she quit drinking. She didn't quit drinking through this program. She just quit drinking, and she was so into being of service and into her church that she was a really wonderful person. And when I made my 9-step amends with her, she in turn made amends with me and apologized to me about my childhood and what happened in my childhood. And I was able to make amends with her about what a daughter I was. I was a lying, cheating mother. That must be the sign I'm supposed to be quiet. Is that the alarm to stop? And so I've had a lot of wonderful experiences like that. And I've had ups and I've had downs. And what I've learned is just to do life on life's terms, whatever it is. I just do life on life's terms. I've learned to compartmentalize really well. I've learned to, through therapy and through working the steps, I've learned to not morbidly reflect. I did a lot of morbid reflection when I got here. I had a negative. I had the film of what happened in my life running over in my head constantly, and I learned to get rid of that, and I learned to shake it all out, and I learned to think about happy things, and I learned to not worry. I'm always saying, if you're going to think about something, you might as well think about something happy, right? If you're going to make stuff up in your head, make up happy stuff, right? There's no reason. I was always making up these really negative stories. Most of them had happened to me. I was just kind of replaying them. But I was always making this stuff up. And through this program, I learned to just, what the hell, make up happy things. And so that's what I try to do. I try to, try to live a good life. I try to just do the next right thing, whatever's in front of me. So again, I want to say happy birthday to the birthday people. I want to thank Denise for asking me, and I really appreciate it. I hope you could hear. Dan, could you hear me? Was it okay? Okay. All right. I want to thank everybody, and have a great night. I'm a little early. Is that okay?
All right.